Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show for Saturday, October 19th, 2002. I'm going to tell you who will be live on the air with us this afternoon and introduce in our studio Lyndon LaRouche. Welcome, Lynn.
Thank you.
And after I introduce the other guests who we will hear from later, I will turn things over directly to Lyndon LaRouche for his opening remarks. Lyndon LaRouche was our guest a week ago, October 12th. It's been a rapid pace of events. Joining us also in the studio is Nancy Spanas, independent Democrat for the United States Senate, the candidate who destroyed Oliver North in 1994 and is going to repeat that treatment of these networks in the 2002 campaign. We'll hear about that later. Lynn, things are moving quickly. Tell us the updates.
What we're looking at November 5th. On November 5th, a change will occur in U.S. politics and international politics. We don't know what the change will be, but we do know there will be a very dramatic change in policy. We are in a situation in which the entire international financial system is collapsing. People who are getting their quarterly reports on their pensions and mutual funds know that. Or if they don't know it today, they'll know it in a few days. The past quarter has been a disaster for most Americans, either with lost jobs, raises in rent because of a collapsing real estate market. Their rents are going up, as in the area right here in the Leesburg area. People's rents are going up because the market is collapsing for real estate. It's one of those little contradictions that go on, isn't it? So we have the worst financial collapse in the memory of any living person in the United States today. That is assured. This is the big issue. The other issue is George Bush's commitment to a war that no one wants. That is, no one Hussein wants this war, including, I understand, most of our top flag officers in the Pentagon and elsewhere, who may not be good strategists, but they know what nuts is, and they don't like this stuff, for good reason. So therefore, we don't know what exactly is going to happen, except we know this November 5th election will be a phase shift in internal politics and therefore in international politics. The war is not yet in. There are attacks on Iraq. We've had attacks on Iraq before. But it's not officially yet the open war. Presently, the situation is jammed up in the United Nations. The United Nations may make an agreement in the Security Council, which is a compromise, but I don't think it'll be a compromise that George wants. Mm. George now has to think about going to a unilateral war, because if the United Nations and doesn't agree with George, Blair may come under tremendous pressure, and he may back off, leaving George all alone with his chicken hawks. He's virtually fired his generals. He's got these draft dodgers out there planning a war. That is not a good situation for the United States. It's a war for which there is no plan to get out of it. Now, in the meantime, we had a little interesting complication. We had an alleged concession from China, from North Korea and China, to the effect that North Korea has been developing nuclear weapons capabilities. These are not probably awesome, but they are significant because they are nuclear weapons capabilities. Now, this has thrown everything into a jam up. Of course, it's obvious that North Korea does not intend to start a nuclear war. Why does it want nuclear weapons then? Why would it have gone on a program which it claims it admitted to the United States is done? We haven't gotten the clarity on that yet, but that's going on. Obviously, they did it to create a bargaining chip. You may recall that the United States was in support of the Sunshine Policy under Clinton. The idea was that we'd bring the two Koreas together and the United States would be the sponsor of some economic assistance and other things which would help this process along. Then things got a little bit crazy, and that was sabotaged, despite many of the people who were still for it. So now North Korea wants money. They want help. They want financial or equivalent help to bail out their ailing economy. They figure now they can use the nuclear bombs as a bargaining chip to get some cooperation from the United States. Okay, we'll give up our nuclear weapons. Give us some help. So obviously, I don't think North Korea is alone in this. I think some other countries in Asia may be thinking in similar directions, is to try to get some sense in Washington. And we're in that kind of period. So we're in a very complicated situation. The financial system is collapsing. The monetary economic system is collapsing. People are suffering in the United States as not since 1929, 1933, more and more of them, and that will increase. We have a government which is determined to stick to an economic policy which is, in fact, under these conditions, clinically insane. They are committed to a war which is, by all standards, is clinically insane. We have a world situation where there's no need for the United States at this time to conduct a war against anyone for any purpose. There is no problem of any significance, strategic significance, in any part of the world that were I the President of the United States today, I could not solve by finding cooperation with other nations to develop solutions. There's no need for anyone to shoot anyone. I also understand this terrorism racket much better than most Americans do, and there are ways that we can deal with that, and it should be dealt with. But there is no reason for a war. There is no sane reason for the economic situation which faces the United States today. Now, here's what we stand face. We are, as I said, in the worst depression in the living memory of any American, probably in centuries, actually, when we look at the bottom line on this thing. We can get out of it. I could get us out of it by methods which are not dissimilar from what Franklin Roosevelt did. Different but not dissimilar from. The same principle, the same general idea. However, it would take us a quarter century, about a generation, for us to rebuild the United States as such, up to the level that we would say we had overcome the effects of the past 35 years of step-by-step collapse of our economy, loss of our industries, transformation from a producer society into a consumer society, so forth and so on. Take a quarter century, which means that we would have to create a system of credit, because most of our banks are bankrupt. Most of the banks, leading banks of Europe, are bankrupt. Chase Manhattan is practically junk, is a junk firm right now. The collapse of Brazil, the collapse of Argentina collectively would probably sink a number of leading U.S. banks, which have a heavy position in South America and Central America. So we're going to have to put the banks through bankruptcy reorganization. We're going to have to use the credit of the United States on long term for with a 25-year perspective of rebuilding the economy, number one. Number two, presenting any avoidable hardship, loss of employment and so forth among people, population generally today. A gradual improvement, restoration of health care, improvements of education, build up of infrastructure, rebuilding our national rail system, protecting and rebuilding our air travel system, and so forth, things like that. So we can solve the problem, but we have to have a system of regulation, because we cannot pay for these things in terms of return on capital expended in the short term. We can buy our way out of this over 25 years with long-term, low-cost federal credit. We can save essential banks, even though they're bankrupt, by federal methods. We will, in effect, either create a national bank of the United States, like the first U.S. bank, or we will do things such as Roosevelt attempted to do. We will organize, through the Treasury, a bankruptcy proceeding for existing banks. We will take all banks which are essential and viable as banks, whether they're bankrupt or not. We will keep them in business in order to maintain pensions, to maintain savings, to maintain credit lines for local businesses. We'll do all these things. But we're going to have to go into hawk, in a sense, long-term credit at 1% to 2% interest rates for a period of up to 25 years. We will buy our way out of this. We'll pay and build our way out of this. We don't have to have any suffering. Get rid of Nixon methods. Get rid of the kinds of things we've done over the past years. So we can solve these problems. Now, we also have the greatest marketing opportunity that we've ever had before. We have giant markets such as China, India, Southeast Asia. We have a great potential in South and Central America if we decide to develop that area rather than ruin it, as we've been doing over the past quarter century. These are tremendous markets for long-term capital goods export, infrastructure development. This means that we can go back to being an industrial power again, an agro-industrial power, restore our agricultural potential based on the independent farmer, high-tech independent farming. We're going to have to rebuild that. It takes us a generation to rebuild it. We're going to have to open up new industries for export of high technology into these great new markets in Central and South Asia, in Central and South America, which is one of our primary markets. So we can have a prosperous future. We can guarantee that the next generation, the generation now in the 18 to 25 age group, that generation's children can have a bright future. Europe has the same kind of problem we have, the same kind of internal problems, economic problems. They have similar kinds of opportunities with slightly different markets than we have. They have the same interests we do. China has a long-term interest in cooperation with us. That's a very large part of the human population. South Asia, Southeast Asia, very large part of the total human population. They have a vital interest in cooperation with us for their future. So, as President of the United States, committed to deal with this depression, committed to avoid any unnecessary wars, we have a bright future. The problem we have is the things are jammed up in Washington. Now, what has to happen is this. We have a Democratic Party, which at the top is right now not worth much. We also have, in the Republican Party, a great number of sane people. You may not believe it, but there's some very sane people, and they're saner than some of our Democrats. On the basis of a patriotic sense of mission, not the kind of partisan politics we've had in recent periods, but a sense of national mission, I believe that we can pull together rather quickly enough of leading Republicans and prominent Democrats that we could walk into the White House sometime after November 5th. If the voters turned out to fix, to make sure the Senate and the House of Representatives are not completely messed up, walk in there and say, Mr. President, we propose that you make some changes in your government. We propose that you get rid of the chicken hawks, these draft dodgers who want to fight war all over the world, such as Richard Perle and Wolfowitz and these other draft-dodging chicken hawks.
Even Newt Gingrich is in there.
He's one of the worst. But anyway, get rid of these guys. Mm-hmm. Bring in the same team. Work with us to build a bipartisan policy to get this world and this nation out of this war danger and out of this economic crisis. I would hope that the results of the November 5th election, midterm, will help to create that kind of environment. I know what to do. I know the president doesn't know what to do. But you don't dump a president, even if he's incompetent. What you do is you build competence around him and try to educate him as to what his true self-interest is as president, to succeed in office. And the rest will say, Mr. President, you may not know what to do. We do. We'll help you. And when we get through with your administration, you will have been a success. On that basis, I think we can change the situation. I know that around the world, from people I talk to in various parts of the world, we can do that. And this, I think, is a perspective.
Lynn, to do this, do you think that the Democrats have to take back the Congress, or could some other combination happen?
We've got a big question mark here. First of all, the people in the Congress who behave very badly, led by Gephardt. This guy behaved like a skunk. And I don't think he has much chance of higher office at any time in the future. I think he just scotched it. Daschle was a disappointment. Obviously, what Senator Byrd did from West Virginia, he did a good job. Kennedy did, given the difficulties he had, a good job. But the Democrats behaved badly. They capitulated to the intimidation, the blackmail, and so forth that Bush and company imposed upon them. That Rumsfeld, well, everybody's got false teeth or not, I don't know, but it was bad, whatever he did. Cheney is a menace. His wife is worse. I mean, you'd want to fire Dick Cheney to get rid of his wife, Lynn. That's if he were. But in any case, the people, now these members of Congress are going back to run for election. one-third of the Senate, so or so forth, and all of the House representatives. When they get back to East Podunk and similar localities, they're going to find that the reality is, contrary to the Washington, D.C. gossip, that the great majority of Americans are concerned about two things: the economy, which is crushing them. Secondly, they don't want the war, just as Europeans don't want the war. And they're going to find that they can get lynched come November 5th in the polls if they don't change their tune. As to whether that's going to happen, I don't know. Right now, the Federal Reserve System, the Treasury, and so forth are committing what I would consider a crime. They're plastering the financial markets with money to try to push up the Dow Jones and NASDAQ and so forth. It's completely fake. I've checked the markets through my sources, and there is no market activity sustaining this apparent 5 out of 6 days growth in the financial market. It's completely faked. It's being faked largely by the U.S. government. It's being faked to try to keep the American people quiet until November 5th, so there is not a revolt, which may eliminate George Bush as governor of Florida and might eliminate some other Republicans on the issue of this war. And might, I would hopefully, can't do it now, eliminate Lieberman, but that's...
He's not up for election, but we can box him in.
We can box him in.
Yeah. Let me say a few words about who is on with us in various locations. You're listening to The LaRouche Show. I'm Michelle Steinberg, counterintelligence co-editor of EIR and editor of Electronic Intelligence Weekly. And we have in various locations listening to Lynn's webcast today, a meeting in Lima, Peru. We have Carrie Lowry, our Democrat, LaRouche Democrat, candidate for state representative in Eastern Michigan, has a meeting in Detroit. We have Lori Dobson, Democratic Party candidate, listening in. She will be speaking to us later, as will Carrie Lowry. And we have the 100th session of the organizers conference call going on today, which had somewhere around 100 people participating in this briefing, listening, preparing questions, preparing to organize for the next week. What Lyndon LaRouche, who was our guest last week, has gone through is a number of crucially important issues. For example, there is no reason for a war with Iraq. Secondly, the figures of this past week's Wall Street rally are a fake to keep the American people quiet. Lynn, everybody's heard of the plunge protection team. It sounds like the old Nixon plumbers or something. Roto-Rooter, what is that about?
I think it's sort of Roto-Rooter, and some people are feeling that in a relevant part of their anatomy. I mean, this was something that was dreamed up in the fall of 1998. You remember that Clinton had threatened in September of 1998 to do something about international financial reform. His then Secretary of the Treasury, Bob Rubin, was leaning in favor of that kind of approach. Then Clinton backed off suddenly, and they hit him with the Monica Lewinsky and other nonsense then.
Right.
And there were a number of changes. But in October, when the Washington Monetary Conference occurred, Clinton had backed off totally. The other G7 nations had backed off totally from any kind of reform. They were faced with a threat of a Brazil crisis to hit about February of 1999. So in this context, one of the leading world drug pusher, George Soros, he says he's a drug legalizer, but in point of fact, he's the mechanic that sets up the situation to help the drug trafficking. Right. Like the New York Stock Exchange, which depends to a great degree on the Colombian drug traffic. That's what, you know, you would dope up the stock market, like doping up racehorses. So he had a guy down in Brazil called Fraga, his puppet. He's still there, finance officer. So Soros came up with this idea of wall of money, we can prevent the Brazil crisis, which at that point was inevitable for the early part of 1999. We can prevent it by flooding it with a wall of money. They went in with a wall of money policy against Brazil, which included what's called dollarization of its debt. It's completely artificial swindle against Brazil. But they went ahead with it. So as a result of that operation, which continued in various forms, from that time up until recently, there's been a continual operation called the Plunge Protection Team, which started under Clinton and continued under the President Bush. This does not work anymore. What I've been doing through my sources in European and other markets and checking this, there is no regular plunge protection operation in place right now. What there is an out-and-out raw operation. And see, in a plunge protection operation, you depend on counterparty relationships. You make swaps, credit debt swaps. Now, what you've got in a situation now where J.P. Morgan Chase Manhattan, which is the biggest derivatives bank in the United States, vulnerable, is no longer a worthy counterparty. Nobody in the world will touch a major agreement with J.P. Morgan Chase right now. It's rumored that they might go under. We don't know. But all the indicators are there close to that. Other banks. So now what's happened, you've had a raw, direct political pouring of money by some means other than just the plunge protection method, which was done, plunge protection in 1998. New method, done for a very short term. It's done simply to get the nation politically through the November 5th election without a big disaster for the Bush Republicans.
That's a very big risk, it seems to me, because it's dramatic changes every day. This week they were saying that the 1,000-point rally, and it looked like the 1,000-point Reich. I mean, it just folded, and then they had to prop it up again. And the consequences, such as the Jeb Bush losing the election down in Florida, on the other side, this instability has contributed to elections of very good people like your friend Enéas Carneiro in Brazil. Now, what does that mean for the prospects of a new Bretton Woods?
Well, what is he dealing with on the banking side? Look at the market. The question is, if the stocks are going up, who is buying? Who is the mysterious buyer?
That's what we want to know.
There is some. That's the point. This is a fraud. This is a gigantic fraud. And it would a kind of gamble that no one would take, not even a government, not even the government of the United States, which is pretty wild these days, would take that unless they were doing it on a very short term. They're saying if we can control power as of November 5th, then we can cover up for the fraud we have committed on the markets to try to get there. In the case of Enéas, it was fun. I was brought in there into Brazil in June to get this honorary citizenship of one of the largest cities in the world, Sao Paulo. But I was also brought in for a number of conferences of strategic implications, and use the occasion of this ceremony of my official inauguration as an honorary citizen to deliver a statement on U.S. foreign policy as my speech in gratitude to the city for this honor. Also, I've laid out things. Now, we also had other discussions, not only with my presence there, but with other parts of the Americas. We've got to a situation which I described then, and which I would describe now, is the United States and the IMF and Brazil are in a mutually hopeless situation. There is no way, under any conditionalities, which Freddy Krueger's sister Annie would like to impose upon on Brazil, under which Brazil could survive. So therefore, if you go ahead with IMF conditionalities, you are going to sink the entirety of South America. Remember, Argentina's about to go. It's in the bucket. Brazil is on the edge of going. It has a dollarized debt. It's galloping growth. They've just gone to over 20% overnight interest rate. It's a killer. Look at Venezuela, about to blow up. Colombia, dominated by the drug market. Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, more or less destroyed. Mexico under a crusher. So we're looking at a situation which, under these conditions, Western Hemisphere conditions alone, under present IMF conditionalities, there's no way that IMF conditionalities can be imposed and maintained without sinking the entirety of the U.S. financial interest in Central and South America. Can't be done. Therefore, the IMF has to give up. There have to be conditions given for reorganization of the indebtedness of the countries of South and Central America, which correspond to what is required to enable these countries to begin to recover from the rape which has been performed on this part of the world since August 15th, 1971. Now, if Brazil were to default, we're talking about an order of $300 billion. If they were to default, that would cause a chain reaction which would sink most of the banks of the United States overnight. So therefore, if the IMF imposes its conditions, causes a default, you would simultaneously sink South and Central America and the U.S. financial system. So we discussed this. We went through some of the figures. George Bush is going to have to give in. Someone is going to have to fire Annie Kruger and get a human being in there to replace her. We're going to have to put the IMF system under reorganization. Let's take one aspect of this. You have in the past 2 days, you have from Prodi of the European Parliament, right. You have also a senator from France have led a chorus saying that the so-called stabilization pact has to be scrapped. The Maastricht agreements have to be scrapped. Europe can no longer accept the conditions which were imposed upon Europe by the combination of the former George Bush, number 41, Mitterrand, and Thatcher. Right. It has to be scrapped for the sake of Europe's survival. So we have around the world, at the same time that the Italian Chamber of Deputies has adopted a policy which I introduced to Italy as by a majority, calling for a new Bretton Woods system, a reorganization of the international monetary system. What we're at is the point that we go to hell when we reorganize the present IMF in the way that I have been proposing for some decades, especially the past decade.
Excellent. Okay. We're going to take a break to make some announcements and then go to questions on how to bring about the new Bretton Woods. You are listening to The LaRouche Show for October 19th, 2002. The LaRouche Show is live on the web on Saturdays from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Today's show is a special edition featuring Lyndon LaRouche, 2004 Democratic Party presidential candidate in the United States, and three leading LaRouche Democrats. Kerry Lowry, elected to be the Democratic candidate for state rep from Eastern Michigan. Lori Dobson, candidate for the 141st District, Connecticut, and Nancy Spanis, candidate, independent Democrat for the United States Senate against neocon warhawk John Warner, who is probably going to flip his toupee when he hears Nancy today. And we will have questions from our audience. You can reach us for the questions to this live webcast at 1-866-857-4327. Sorry, let me repeat that. 1-866-857-4327. There are operators standing by to answer those lines. International callers can reach us at 703-777-9451 or 703-443-8419. The preferred number is 703-443-8419. If you'd like to send a question by email, our address is radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio at LaRoucheP.com. I'm going to go back to Lyndon LaRouche with our first question today. Lynn, it's about North Korea and China. The question comes from the Washington, D.C. correspondent for a Chinese publication called 21st Century World Herald. And that is Zhang Gangxiao. And he has several related questions. He says, do you think the omission of North Korea about its clandestine nuclear weapon plan justifies President Bush's rationale of evil axis? If yes or not, why? Secondly, do you think United States should work on an international effort to remove the potential nuclear weapon from North Korea? Why? Third, what kind of role can China play in terms of stabilizing the North Korea peninsula, specifically on this particular matter? So going back to the first one about the admission, do you think that this justifies Bush's axis of evil?
No, it does not. This is one of those cases which I referred earlier, where somebody wants to start a war or something tantamount to going into a war, where the problem can be solved in a completely different manner. The problem is this. There are problems in many countries. North Korea has its own internal problems, political as otherwise. But when you're dealing in the real world, you have to realize that many countries have governments you may not particularly like, or that they have internal problems which you find particularly offensive or dangerous. Now, when you're a great power, like the United States, and when we behave sanely, we can get a lot of cooperation from Europe in general and elsewhere. So we have great power, greater political power actually than we have military power. Mm-hmm. We have to know how to use it. Now, under our Constitution, which is unique in the world, the office of President of the United States is the most powerful position, elected office, of any nation state in the world. Because under our system, unlike European systems, the presidency represents the executive power of government. And therefore, the presidency is all-powerful in the sense of fulfilling that responsibility. The Congress, is legislative branch, is not an executive agency and should not try to become one. The courts are not an executive agency. Mm-hmm. So our system of government under our Constitution is unique. You have to know how to use that power. The president is responsible. The president of the United States can't, if they are a president, just to hypothetical, to get the picture. If I go to the governments of Europe, including Russia, go to the British government, go to the Canadian government, others, and say, we have a problem, they're going to talk. So we have to come to a joint understanding of what we're going to do. We'll talk. And they'll accept the idea of the United States playing the role of leadership, the U.S. executive playing the role of leadership in that situation. Now you come to a case like North Korea, a troubled country created by circumstances of the 19 post-Roosevelt period, which says, that, according to the report, it has nuclear weapons. That is a problem. How do we solve the problem? Well, we have to look at the context. We also have in South Korea a president of South Korea, very amiable and capable man, who's part of the Sunshine Policy. We've secured, with the help of Russia and China, we have secured agreement for North Korea and South Korea to cooperate in linking the rail connection system of North and South Korea. What does that mean? Japan has been brought in to help finance this by coming up with a reparations grant to fund the building of this link connecting the rail system of North and South Korea. What does that mean? That means for Japan, from the port of Busan at the southern extremity of Korea to Rotterdam, we have continuous rail connections throughout Eurasia. This means we have similar benefits for China. China is now working on rail connections which lead from China through Burma into Bangladesh, India. We have now in process the possibility of opening up a gigantic market to transportation corridors for development of the continent of Eurasia. China has a tremendous market. It's a poor country in large, but has a tremendous market. But it needs the kind of cooperation under which it can use long-term credit for its internal development and can afford to buy what it needs for its own long-term internal development and through cooperation with adjoining nations. So therefore, my concern with Korea is I want to save not only the Korean stability and achieve reunification of Korea in the long term in cooperation now. I have to be concerned as an American president with the interests of Japan as well as Korea, the interests of China, the interests of Russia, especially the eastern Russia. Mm-hmm. I have to be concerned with the implicit interests of Southeast Asia in security, with also with relations between China and India, Pakistan, and so forth. So therefore, my approach to this is not how do I beat somebody over the head in North Korea because I don't like the nuclear arsenal up there. It's dangerous. What do I do? What I do is I call the president of China and say, you're the key party in here. Can we talk to our mutual friends in North Korea and see what they want to get rid of that thing that bothers us? I guarantee we succeed.
That's very, very apt because the current president, Bush 43, is going to be exactly in a situation to be meeting the president of China in the very near future. Do you think we could persuade him to take that approach?
Well, I think the president of China is going to have that in his eyes, that glint in his eye, when he meets the president of the United States. I can't tell what the president of China is thinking, but I know that he's an intelligent man, a very intelligent man. I know something of his history, and I know what's going to be on his mind as a topic of discussion when he looks into the eyes of our president here. And certainly he's going to be concerned with that. I wouldn't be surprised if the whole revelation of the existence of this nuclear capability in China, which has happened some time ago, remember, this has just been leaked, mm-hmm. but the official knowledge of this acknowledgement was earlier, that this was done precisely to try to get a negotiation with the United States in the direction I've just suggested I would do. Mm-hmm. And I would do it. I think if the President of the United States is intelligent, he could get something very easily. He could call Bill Clinton up. Bill and I don't always agree, but I think this would work. I think Bill Clinton, as a former president, would join, because he'd had a policy on this unification policy, mm-hmm. and was involved in this negotiation. I think that Bill Clinton would be prepared to strengthen the out on this thing, to join with President Bush in supporting a kind of bipartisan commitment to that kind of solution to this problem posed by these nuclear capabilities. And I think that the government of China, with Jiang Zemin coming in, would be very happy to have that proposition put on his plate.
Just finishing up with our question from our friend from the World Herald, I think you've answered it a great deal. He says, do you agree China should join the U.S. international effort on this particular matter and on Iraq? If yes, why? If not, how do you think China should deal with the Bush government?
Well, I think on the Iraq thing, we've got to look at it somewhat differently. I think on this case, I think the Secretary of State might be a very appropriate person to be involved in this, as opposed to the president, to advise the president on this. Because this is a new issue, it's somewhat separate from Iraq. On the question of Iraq, we have a deeper question. It is well known that our flag officers, serving flag officers and others, in large degree, think or have suggested that what the president's policy for Iraq, the policy of the chicken hawks, around Cheney's chicken hawks, or maybe Lynn Cheney's chicken hawks, is insane. The whole Iraq policy is insane. We don't need it. We don't want it. It serves no purpose. I think if I were president, I would have no problem with our military on that question. We don't need that war. It serves no purpose. If we have problems, we have much better ways to solve them. and that the president has been lied to by the people who advised him on this thing. So the problem in that case is, how do you get the president of the United States to accept the fact that he has been massively lied to by maybe Lynn Cheney's chicken hawks, Richard Pearl and company, that the president has been fooled and played the fool and been played for a fool by Ariel Sharon, who is a descendant, and politically, of a known professed fascist, Vladimir Zev Jabotinsky. And he is a fascist, too. So we have an Israeli fascist who's becoming increasingly unpopular with the Israeli population and with international Jewry, is foisting upon the United States, with the help of this collection of chicken hawks, these draft dodgers, a war which we don't need and the Middle East doesn't need and which Israel doesn't need. So in this case, I don't think it's that China is the real thing. China's part of the Security Council of the United Nations. There it comes in. But I think the problem here is to get the president de-brainwashed, freed of the grip of these chicken hawks. So it's a different problem than the North Korea problem.
Well, one of the ways to do that is to have absolute clarity on what this terrorism problem is, and especially the so-called Al-Qaeda, which is now supposedly here, there, everywhere. You spoke about this on September 11th, 2001, as the events were unfolding. Tell us about this panic.
The problem here is in the case of Afghanistan, the Taliban's were a problem, without question. They had nothing to do with September 11th, 2001. Nothing. They are a part of an international terrorism problem. There are elements of Al-Qaeda which are problematic. But Al-Qaeda is not a coherent, simple organization. There are no independent powers of terrorism. It's like some crazy James Bond thing, some secret power, supranational power, outside government, the big enemy you have to conduct. There is no such international terrorism. Terrorism is an operation which, in the sense it's significant, strategically significant, is run by governments. It's not run as an independent force outside governments. There are no significant terrorist organizations which are not a front for a government. I know you've dealt with the thing. For example, in the case of Italy, 1970s, right? 1980s in Germany. We now know, in the Italian case, the Italian terrorists were a branch of an Anglo-American operation run under NATO cover, which was set up as Gladio, as a post-war stay-behind organization in Italy for the contingency of a Soviet invasion or a communist takeover of Italy. Now, this organization had three components, Gladio, initially. One, it had Christian Democrats. Two, it had communists and socialists. Three, it had fascists. When the fascists were brought in to Gladio, by the United States, by the British, and under NATO later, when they were brought in, the communists and the social democrats and Christian Democrats backed away from Gladio because of the fascist component. It was this fascist component, run by an Anglo-American operation in Italy, which ran the terrorism and the ultra-left violent groups in Italy during the 1970s and into the 1980s. In terms of the case of Germany, the terrorism which was the so-called anti-nuclear terrorism in Germany, the so-called Baader-Meinhof and similar gangs that came out of it, that was all run by the same kind of group. Anglo-American interests in cooperation, as was shown later, with the Stasi, the secret service of East Germany. You had people in Germany who were both Stasi agents and Western agents who are running these kinds of operations. What we know about terrorism, and I've worked with some of the top specialists against terrorism in the world in various countries, any significant terrorism is run by governments. There is no such thing as international terrorism. That is a myth. There are specific terrorist capabilities which exist, which are run. Any significant terrorist operation which somebody tried to set up as an independent operation in any major country could be shut down within a matter of days. We have the police investigative capabilities to knock them out. If it's around, it's because somebody's letting it run loose. And that's what happened in the case of September 11, 2001. Somebody ran an operation inside our house but they ran it from inside our house. And we were negligent. We didn't take the precautions and maintain the precautions to deal with that kind of threat, which we should have known existed because of the upcoming financial crisis. And a financial crisis of a global systemic nature brings forth these kinds of dangers. We had let our guard down. And it was our own responsibility. Don't go blaming people in other countries for this. It wasn't. It was people in our own country, principally, who had let our security services down, that is the real ones, not the funny guys investigating Nazi-style, Himmler-style local community spies, but real security. We let it down. And what we found on looking at the score after the attack on the Pentagon and the Twin Towers had passed over, we found the things that we had assumed were there to protect us from such operations weren't functioning that day, and maybe hadn't been functioning for a number of months. So that's the problem. So we should get rid of this myth about international terrorism and get some people in who really understand this stuff. Get off this newspaper and Justice Department propaganda. We know what we're dealing with. We know how to deal with this thing without creating a police state.
Thank you, Lynn. We are getting loaded up with questions and emails. But staying on this theme, this actually comes from one of our colleagues at EIR, Scott Thompson, and it's on what you've been addressing about the chicken hawks. At the Labor Day keynote address, you laid out what needs to be done in terms of rebuilding American infrastructure. Right now, the chicken hawks are screaming about war in the Middle East that may blow up the world. You have a host of neocons, Darbyite so-called Christian Armageddonists, and every other kind of slime mold emerging when you turn over a new rock in the Bush administration. What's your assessment on the possibility of cleaning out this snake pit and putting you in as the elder statesman telling President Bush what must be done?
I think if you wanted to clean up the snake pit, what you do is you'd hit it on the flank. There are a lot of different varieties of snakes and kooks and so forth. They're floating in our environment. But what you want to do is you want to turn the tide. Mm-hmm. So you pick one target which will turn the tide. Okay, the place to hit is the Moonies. The most important and most significant nut factor, which is a serious threat to our political order inside the United States, is the Moonies. Now, the Moonies are well known. They, of course, were closely associated with Nazi Spanish's old adversary, Oliver North, in the days of Colza. That was what Moonies were, running this Virginia operation, in part. Mm-hmm. This was Iran-Contra, the Moonies. These are people who have money that doesn't exist, but they spend it. They buy souls for gold watches. They said Christ was a fake, that the Reverend Moon is the real thing, and you have to marry a bride chosen by Moon, and you might be saved. They're buying up, they're behind the part of the reparations operation. They're buying up politicians. They control Falwell. They control most of the far right, religious right in this country, is controlled and coordinated with the Moonies. There's a key figure called Bohee Park, Colonel Bohee Park, who's very close to drug pushers in various parts of the world. Comes out of Asia. Now, what we're doing, the way you deal with a thing like this, is you expose it. You don't go out and tell lies about it. You don't do what the Washington Post does and go out and tell terrible lies about somebody because you want to hurt them. No, you tell the truth. And the truth is the best weapon. You tell the truth about the Reverend Moon and Bohee Park and who he's buying up and who he's selling and how he bought up Jerry Falwell, how he bought up Vigory, how he is at the center of the far right, the racist far right in the country, and how many African Americans, so-called, are being bought by Moon to work in bed with the racist anti-black far right. You pull that out, and I guarantee you the biggest factor of loose religious and other kinds of nuts in the United States will scamper, and the rest of the mess will be cleaned up.
That's a good one. Going back to the questions, we have an email call from Lopez, and asking who would have the power to declare the 25th Amendment of the Constitution, and why has no one done anything now to remove this present administration from destroying the world? A frequent question, get rid of Bush, not change the geometry.
That's a mistake. The Constitution of the United States is very important. It's the only constitution of its type on the planet. It was designed by Europeans, led by Benjamin Franklin, under conditions that such a constitutional form of government could not be established in Europe because of the religious wars and so forth, which had made a mess of Europe. But Europeans made it possible. So therefore, we have an instrument of government in our constitution whose fundamental principle is the preamble. The preamble contains three elements. One, the sovereignty of the United States, which is absolute. There is no higher authority than the sovereignty of the United States, number one. Number two, no law, no policy, no tradition is enforceable under our Constitution, which is inconsistent with that principle of the general welfare, otherwise known as the common good. Third, that is not sufficient to maintain the general welfare of the present population, we are as accountable and more accountable for our posterity than we are for ourselves living today. Now, that Constitution has provided an executive power under it, which is the most efficient instrument of government in the world for executive power. You don't tamper with that. You don't monkey with that for expedient reasons. You don't shoot a president. You don't impeach him for trivial causes. You don't impeach him except to save the Constitution. You never use the Constitution to impeach a president. You impeach a president to save the Constitution, the integrity of government. Now, so therefore, what you go at is the corruption. Now, for example, how can you criticize George W. Bush? He's not to blame. He didn't make himself president. We had two candidates, both of whom were eminently unqualified for the office of president, perhaps also unqualified to be dog catcher, for all I know. And the American people, in their wisdom, and the political parties, reduced the number of eligible leading candidates for presidency of the United States in the year 2000 to two guys. One guy of limited mental capability, the present president, the man who was run by, who was controlled by his teleprompter. The other is a guy who is a little bit not all there, rather eccentric, funny, not all there. So don't blame the present president for the fact that he's president. He didn't make himself president. He is president. What we have to do in a case like this is we have to do two things. First of all, we have to say, okay, unless this president has done something impeachable, he stays. And I will lead the procession to say he stays, unless he's impeachable. Right? The other thing is, of course, the mental problem. But that's the same idea. You act to save the Constitution, not use the Constitution for inconvenience, to eliminate inconveniences. All right. So George Bush is an inconvenience because of his limitation. You don't dump him, and you don't try to dump him with scandal or orchestrated games. He's not the problem. The problem is the system. The problem is the same rotten political system that gave us two unworthy presidential candidates as the only choices for the voter in general in the year 2000. And that's what you have to fix. Don't be a single-issue nut. Mm-hmm. See, some people think, well, I got five things, and I'm going to pick a president based if he supports me on these five things, or promises to. He never will do it, but he'll promise it. That citizen is a nut. He should go out and sit in the outhouse and cry. And say, I am a nut. Single issuism does no place in sane politics. Politics proceeds from questions of policy and principle. What is the fundamental interest of the United States? What is the sovereignty of the United States? What is the general welfare of the United States? What is the condition of the posterity of the United States? And what are the principles consistent with that preamble of the Constitution under which we act? That's what you should vote for, and nothing different. Now, there are certain issues which are issues of principle, not single-issue kinds of principle, but issues of general principle, like a universal physical principle. these are the issues we have to function on. For example, principle today. In 1944, at the Democratic Convention of summer 1944, a bunch of clowns said, we're going to get rid of Roosevelt. Roosevelt's going to be elected for the next term, his fourth term. But he's not going to serve up the term because he's got bad health. Therefore, we're going to get a vice president nominated, contrary to the president's desire, who will be our man when the president is no longer in office, when he dies. That was Harry Truman. This process, done by this bunch of clowns at the 1944 Democratic Convention, set into motion the horror shows which we experienced in the post-war period, including the unleashing of this utopian military policy whose objectives were to eliminate Eisenhower, eventually, but immediately MacArthur, and anything like him or Roosevelt from U.S. politics, and to destroy the constituency which had elected Franklin Roosevelt to four successive terms. So the country was changed. This change, especially after Eisenhower left office. Eisenhower was the last president who could control the utopians, which we know today as these draft-dodging chicken hawks who want war all over the world. When he was out, Kennedy could not cope with the utopians. He was brainy enough. He was learnable. He could learn enough. He could do the job. But he didn't have the influence on the military that was needed. And he talked to MacArthur too late.
Right.
If he talked to MacArthur a little bit earlier, he might have had some advice to how to deal with the problem. But they killed him. Johnson was impotent because of that. Not totally impotent. He did two good things on civil rights. But he was a prisoner of these guys. Since that time, since this process, 1964 approximately, the United States underwent a change from being the world's leading producer nation to a consumer society, a post-industrial consumer society, a decadent nation, which we are today, in imitation of ancient imperial Rome. Instead of producing our own wealth, we stole it from the people over whom we had the power to extract it. And that's what our problem is today.
Thank you, and we hope to have you both back again soon.